Welcome to Moving Averages, a new financial podcast from Vox Markets. This series will feature expert market analysis, interviews with top traders and commentators, and much more to bring you fresh insights into the world of finance.
Today, I had the honour of interviewing Jack D. Swaig. Jack is a whale when it comes to the financial industry. He's a well-known author, fund manager, industry expert, and all-round good guy. He's published numerous books such as Market Wizards, New Market Wizards. He's invented and developed his own technical indicators. He's a frequent seminar speaker and lectures on a range of analytical topics, you know, such as sort of investment facilities, hedge fund portfolio, manager accounts, technical analysis, you name it, he's done it. Fascinating conversation with him. I really enjoy speaking to him. So give it up for Jack. So Jack, we're live. Great to speak to you again.
Yeah.
And welcome to Vox Markets podcast.
Thank you very much.
For some of our listeners or some of the newbies who may not be familiar with you, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay. Been around for a long time, so I'll try to make a concise version of it. We're in the financial industry. I'm probably best known for the books I've written, and predominantly a series of books that all go by the name of Market Wizards, Market Wizards, New Market Wizards, Hedge Fund Market Wizards, etc. Those are my primary claim to fame. They've been pretty widely read, at least certainly in the industry and beyond, and widely translated across the globe. And I've also written analytical books, such as The Complete Guide to the Futures Markets and others, which are for maybe more serious readers. I've also been a research director on Wall Street for derivative or futures departments for over 20 years with major firms such as Prudential and Bain Weber, et cetera. And I was a partner with a London-based hedge fund advisory firm, which is where we met many years ago.
Indeed.
Which got acquired, a firm that no longer exists because they got acquired by Close Brothers, another UK entity. And currently I'm involved as a partner in a financial tech startup called Fundseeder, which we'll perhaps get to. That's the short version.
Okay, great. I mean, I'm going to step back to your books because that's how I first got to hear about you. And I think the first book I read actually was New Market Wizards, so I'd sort of do it the wrong way around, I suppose. But going back to those days, I mean, I was sort of fascinated, reading and learning about these top traders. So of all the traders and investors that you interviewed, Jack, I mean, was there anybody that particularly stood out, you know, that you sort of felt their style was the best?
Yeah, and that's almost an impossible question to answer because there were so many top-tier great traders that I interviewed. I mean, how do you choose, say, between picking some known names like Paul Tudor Jones and Bruce Kovner? And then there are many names that were not known to the general public but were every bit as great. And in fact, like somebody like Michael Marcus was actually a mentor and hired Bruce Kovner. So, and that's just a few traders off the top of my head, but there's scores of traders of that caliber within the various Market Wizard books. So it's almost impossible to really say one stood out. Mm-hmm. Many stood out, for many reasons. It's just like, it's one of those answers one of those questions that doesn't allow an easy answer.
Okay. What got you first into trading then?
Basically, fate or luck. I was looking for, I was out of graduate school for an economics degree and was looking for an analytical position and basically just fell into a research position, a futures research analyst. Actually, oddly enough or ironically enough, the position that was being vacated by Michael Marcus, who was chapter one of the first Market Wizards book, and he was leaving, quote, to become a trader, obviously, unquote. Obviously, did very well at that, and I was kind of coming in, taking his position, and we talked, for a little bit when that transition. He remained in New York for a year or two, so we developed a friendship and got together while he was still in the city. And years later, when I was doing this, wanted to do the, got this idea of doing a Market Wizards book, he was one of the first people that I contacted.
Would you say he was a bit of a mentor to you then?
No, he wasn't. Actually, I mean, many of the people I interviewed were influential because they did provide good advice. And of course, which advice is most pertinent really depends on the individual. Mm-hmm. In that sense, through my books, I made, several mentors absorbing different things from different people. But if I had any mentor at all, it would be a very good friend who unfortunately died a couple of years ago, my name is Stephen Kronowitz. And he actually was an analyst who worked for me. And I was a research director and had a bunch of fundamental analysts working for me and one technical analyst. And at the time, coming from an economics background, I was sort of inherently or intrinsically biased against the whole something like technical analysis. It seemed too, too wishy-washy. I don't know. It wasn't like sound statistics or whatever. So I was skeptical. But what I did notice, though, that while most of my analysts really didn't do all that well in their recommendations, the one who was doing well was Steve Kronowitz, who's the technical analyst. So, and we worked in the same office, and we became good friends, and we had a great sense of humor, and all that. So, one day I said to him, "Hey, Steve, why don't you tell me what you do?" It sort of went from there. And once I began to understand what was behind it, then I got the concept that I needed to have a rational explanation. And once I understood that, well, essentially, technical analysis is nothing more than a mirror of what everybody in the world is doing in the market. Nobody can hide. Somebody buys or sells, it shows up in price. So in that sense, what you're seeing is a reflection of all the buy and sell decisions. And therefore, it is not crazy that there might be information there, or that information could be used to trade. And the other big thing about technical analysis, and this is a bias that may have come bias from mine, even though I started in fundamental analysis and eventually transitioned to technical analysis, it's a bias of mine, I say, because for certain people, many of the people I interviewed, fundamental analysis worked great for them, and they would go broke if they tried using technical analysis. Everybody got to decide what's right for them. But for me, why I found actually the technical analysis work was much better was that it fit very naturally with using money management, whereas fundamental analysis, by its very nature, is almost in conflict with good money management. Like, so if I decide, say, that the cotton is a good buy at 50 cents or whatever, let's say as an example, and it goes down to 40 cents, then it's a better buy. So in other words, whatever trade you make, if it goes against you, if the fundamentals haven't changed, if that's your motivation for trade, the more it goes against you, the better of a trade it seems to be. And sort of that is a recipe for going broke on one bad analysis. So the fact that technical analysis, for most approaches to technical analysis, will inherently get you out if you're wrong by anything significant, it was much more comfortable to trade because it meshed much better with money management. And money management, I learned through my own Market Wizard books, is probably the most important thing you need to know to be a good trader.
Yeah, I'd certainly agree with you there. I remember back in the day when doing point and figure by hand and things like that, before computers came out, and money management was all about that then. And but you must have seen an incredible evolution over the years, given that the access to computer processing power and everything. I mean, what would you say has changed now compared to what it was, say, 20 years ago?
Yeah, it's been tremendous evolution. I remember my senior year in college, I went to graduate school, still doing programming on an IBM mainframe, which took up a good sized room and used computer punch cards, and probably had, I don't know what what tiny fraction of an iPhone computing power. But, you know, so that's where things were sort of right before, and even in my early, you know, beginning years when I got into the industry. So we went from that into a world where there's just massive computing power, even forget about quant firms and supercomputers and everything else, but even in the hands of just an ordinary individual, spending $1,000 on a PC nowadays gets a tremendous amount of computing power. So that is a big change. Let alone if you go into the world of supercomputing or having scores of highly trained quants apply mathematical techniques to trading, you're able to do, with the aid of that processing power, you are able to do trading strategies that were literally impossible, totally impossible to even think about doing when I first started in business. So certainly computers have changed by changing the investment financial world, by creating and opening up lots of strategies which were not as feasible before. They also made it such that certain techniques that might have worked well, say, in the early years when I was in the business and worked well for a number of people I interviewed, particularly those who had started at the same time period. So techniques like, you know, trend following, which became very, very easy, which are very easy to duplicate simple programs, those type of methodologies lost a lot of their efficacy because they just became accessible to a lot of people. It did change the ability of those programs to be applied with good return risk characteristics, even though there are still definitely trends in the market, but they've become far choppier, far more likely to take out trend systems, to have false temporary short price moves, false breakout, all that. I think those things have become more prevalent, and trend following, the same trend following techniques that might have worked phenomenally well in the 60s, 70s, even into the 80s, now are quite a different story. So that's like another example of change. So there are a lot of changes of that type. What has not changed is just the basic nature of markets. By nature, I mean the extent to which markets are influenced and driven by human emotions, and which lead to such things as price bubbles and panic sell-offs, and those things existed 100 years before, if not more, you know, or back as far as you want to go in the markets. They existed all the way through the history of financial markets before computers even existed, and they continue today. And that's because human nature is human nature, so that hasn't changed.
There'll always be support and resistance levels.
Well, that's more so than always support and resistance. Well, support and resistance is still a valid concept, although maybe a little more difficult to take advantage of. However, you can marry that concept with money math and still probably have an effect, you know, have an edge in trading. But I'm thinking more so in terms of having absurd things occur, like the internet bubble. If you take that example, culminating in the beginning of early 2000, where you had scores or hundreds of companies who were actually just bleeding money trading. Well, there were no multiples because they had negative income. There was no income. Net income. So, but companies which, you know, should have been trading at pennies, you know, trading for $200 or whatever. And of course, 6 months later, they were trading for pennies or bust completely. So that type of thing, that's what I mean, those type of things. And then you had 2000, yeah, the same repeat, different cause, but same type of theme. In 2008, you had, real estate, housing, particularly, and and a lot of securitizations that were tied to housing. Maybe the absurdity of that was even greater than in 2000, because there you had fixed income mortgage-backed securities, which if you drill down to the units, to the actual assets that were at the bottom of the pile, you were talking about subprime, you know, and poor subprime mortgages, which were given out to people very liberally who couldn't afford to pay them. And it was the worst of the worst garbage. Yet those securities, the way they were combined, and some either naive or malicious assumptions about correlations, which had no justification and logic, but because of that, and rating agencies who were either extraordinarily naive or incredibly stupid, but there's no other. I only see those two alternatives. I mean, you could say that they were going along for self-interest and really almost, I won't use the word fraud, but use whatever word you want to use. Or you could say they were just incredibly stupid, and yet they're the experts rating these things. But it's on one of those two. And with all of that, then you have securities like this that were selling for 25 basis points higher return than U.S. T-bonds. Now, what universe does that make any sense? This is only 2008, so we're talking modern times, you know, computers, everything. Mm-hmm. So what causes that type of stuff? What causes that type of stuff is human nature. And of course, those things also went nearward, were either totally worthless or nearward. So that's what I mean. Those are aspects of the markets. That's what doesn't change. And that's why I think there continue to be opportunities in markets.
It's very interesting. So what were you a big critic, or I mean, I suppose did you make a lot of money out of the crash in 2008?
No, I didn't. I did make money on the recovery, but I didn't make money on the crash. Well, I mean, I bought in. When the crash was, you know, deeply underway, I just remember thinking, well, this kind of just seems like the classic, you know, panic. And I'm talking about things like emerging market indexes being down 75-80%, metal market ETFs, being down 70-80%, that type of stuff. And basically thinking to myself that, well, yeah, I have no idea how far the bottom is, or whatever. But I just thought, well, yeah, you just buy into something like this, put it away, forget about it. That's going to probably work over the long run. I wasn't smart enough. Actually, I shouldn't say that, because I did mention that, with Fortune, I worked for Fortune, asset management, hedge fund advisory, and one of our allocations, we did allocate to, I got a mental block here. which is terrible. I mean, I know the manager well, and now I'm getting a mental block. But he was one of the big players who put together a fund to play the short side of the mortgage-backed securities. And if you think of the name, just shut it out. Like, I'm going to kick myself after this is over. Anyway, but he was just such a logical. It was one of those things where the asymmetry, where if you were wrong, you could lose a little bit amount of money, but if you're right, you could make a tremendous multiples. Mm-hmm. And I remember we made an exception because we never would invest in anything that would lock up of a year or longer. And that fund of his had a lockup of 3 years. But it was such a compelling, it was the logic of it was so compelling, mm-hmm. That, you know, so only in that minor way did I really get something out of it. I can't take credit for being smart enough to really profit from that part, from that element.
I remember a long time ago reading an interesting article by Victor Sperandioza. You pronounce it? I think you did. You interview him once.
I know what you mean. Sperandio,
it was a long time ago, but I remember him talking about the markets and sort of sort of trying to equate the market to sort of life insurance. And, you know, the older you get, the more expensive life insurance is. So the longer a bull market has been going on, the sort of less risk you should put into it, the same way as an insurance company would look at it. And that's come back into my mind a lot, because we've seemed to have been on this bull run forever now, well, certainly since about 2009. I mean, what's your views on it? I mean, it's had so many excuses to go down.
My opinion here doesn't really mean very much, but the way I explain it, the way I explain it for myself at this point is, I think what this gave this market a tremendous second wind was the U.S. Tax cut, I'm very, very careful to use the word tax or deficit finance tax cut. I'm very careful to use that as opposed to tax reform, because it was by far the furthest thing removed from the tax reform. It was basically a budget-busting deficit giveaway. But in that, it really just made companies way more profitable, and also gave them a lot of money to buy back their own stocks. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. The fiction was that they were going to hire all these people, which I don't know what universe you live in that you expect to have a tremendous boost in growth when your unemployment is near full employment, that's not exactly the time you prime the pump. So the money had to go somewhere, and it went back into, a lot of it, I think, just went back into their own stock. So that's been a big supporting element. And they're much more profitable because the taxes are way, way, way lower. So, I think that is one strong reason why you have this bull market still holding very firm. And that's probably not played out. So I don't know how far it goes. It's certainly getting a bit on in time. That element, though, does give you good fundamental reasons why it could push, it could go more. So insofar as I'll ever trade it, I would only trade it from a technical standpoint. I can never trade the short side fundamentally. I mean, I gave you the example of 2008 where I would be, where I did buy, say, emerging market in metal, commodity-type ETFs, because I just thought they were just, you could just buy and hold. But you can't do that on the short side. So I'll never trade a stock market or any market on the short side.
You wouldn't trade an ETF then? Or
an ETF, other than through an option. I might buy, if I really thought it was top, maybe I would buy a put. But I would never sell outright to try to pick a top. Because I guess I shouldn't say that. I might do that under certain circumstances, but it's going to be always influenced by technical, not fundamental. And if I do it technically, it's always going to have a stop associated with the trade, so it becomes a limited risk trade anyway. So right now, I don't see anything warrant a technical position. I think it's a possibility this whole price action that we're seeing is a top. And for the moment, I am looking to sell. If we, I do have a sell order in way above the market, below the highs, but above the last relative high, major relative high. But that's just a technical trade, and that my expect for various reasons. I'm looking at concentration of resistance in that area, and I'm willing to take a shot there with a protective stop. But that's purely a tactical trade. And by the time you get up there, the formation may be such that I may not even want to do it. But right now, I just have it there, so I don't think, I didn't. The market's nowhere near it. But now, if we went there, I would be willing to sell. But my mind might well change because of the way that the charts develop. So that's purely a technical consideration.
Okay, great. What advice would you give to a newbie then, who's looking to get into trading?
Yeah, so the first thing is, it's not as easy as you think it's going to be. But you start by, I think you always should start by reading a lot. And there's a million different types of approaches to the market, and there's no way for you, if anybody's new to the market, to really know what approach is going to be right and make sense. So you sample, you read different books, whether they're fundamental or technical, and start to get a feel for what resonates and feels right for you. Then start applying it to the market, not so much not with real money, I would say, in the beginning, but just try to figure out, what your approach is and what what you would do. And part of that approach should always have a risk management side to it. And when you think you're ready to trade, begin with less money than you're inclined to, because most people end up losing when they start. So you might as well pay less for that education. So that's the gradual process. You begin by reading, then by doing research, then by trying to apply developing some sort of methodology, applying it to the market, seeing how it works. If you think it seems to be working, you can try it with real money, but not too much, and go from there.
Great stuff. Is there any particular indicator? I mean, I know you've sort of innovated your own technical indicators, but is there any sort of style or anything from a technical perspective then that you'd say, okay, this is what I would go with if, let's say, for instance, you're stuck on a desert island and you can choose sort of two or three sort of indicators or patterns or, styles of charting. What do you think those would be? I know I'm putting you on the spot here, but...
Yeah, well, for me, all I would ask for is just the price charts, but, of different price lengths, and the ability to go back, to be able to look at 10 and 20 year charts down to 1 year charts, and occasionally maybe even to maybe intraday charts, but that's less important in particular. But other than just basic charts, I don't. And speaking here for myself, I wouldn't want any indicators. I wouldn't use them. I wouldn't need that. I would just need the basic charts. And the one thing I would request, though, is those charts for the long-term charts. For long-term charts, I would need to see them in both forms of nearest futures, like all continuous futures, which are price-adjusted link series. If you're talking about futures markets because of the price gaps created. But certainly for 1, 2, 3 year charts, for me, having those link charts are critical, because otherwise you've got these jumps between contracts, which are nothing more than just you move from one contract to the other and they look like price moves. So they can be very misleading.
Yeah.
So I would need to be able to look at charts both ways. Now, when you go back far enough, then price levels are significant. And so it's like one type of chart, what I would call the nearest futures, accurately reflects price levels. The other type of chart accurately reflects price wings, or another way of saying it, accurately reflects your equity price wings. And so I think it's critical to look at both.
Would you then say that, would you go with a linear chart or non-linear?
Arithmetic versus exponential, maybe.
Yes.
I said exponential. It's logarithmic. If you go back long enough, then so that if you look, for example, at a 50 or 60 year stock chart, it would seem to you that the markets have increasingly gotten more explosive on the upside. Well, not really. What you're really seeing is just the same 10% move when you have an index is 20,000 is going to look 20 times as big as when the index is 1,000. So if you're looking at really long-term charts, then a logarithmic scale is good, because equal percentage price moves look equal. And so that certainly has a place for very long-term charts. If you're looking at charts 10 years or under, that becomes less critical. Even for a 10-year chart, you can make an argument that looking at a logarithmic scale may be reasonable too.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit more about Fund Seeders. I'm fascinated to hear about this.
Yeah, so Fund Seeder, that's my current endeavor. I'm one of three founding partners. Fund Seeder, basically the concept of Fund Seeder was that there are God knows how many thousands of great traders globally who will never, ever, ever have a chance to manage assets or even get close to having the opportunity to present any real institutional allocators, because they're in the wrong country, they don't have the right pedigree in universities, whatever, any number of reasons. You're just a large amount of the world's traders are just shut out, even if they're really talented. So the basic idea was create a web-based site that which traders globally could connect to, link their accounts to OneSeeder and have but what that means is we get the results from the broker, not from the trader, and basically create verified trading accounts and have a chance of being discovered. And they also get this. Also, the platform has a free analytics, so they can, you know, you get plots. You know, you can see your equity curve plotted. It updates daily. You know, you don't do anything. You can generate stuff like underwater charts or all the performance stats. And so it's a lot of freebie analytics, which is to entice traders to sign up. But it also gives an opportunity to for traders worldwide to get discovered. And on the other side of the fence, you know, we have the investment company, which OneSeeder Investments, which works with investors and allocators who are looking for undiscovered trading balance. So you can think of us as kind of a matchmaker in that sense, or a go-between who connect talented traders worldwide. And we have signups incredibly. We have signups from literally 120 countries. I wouldn't have thought there were traders in 120 countries. I mean, that's really extraordinary. And when I've been looking at some of the results and searching our own database and interviewing some of these traders who have the best track records, and by best I don't mean highest return. I mean people who have been delivering good returns with very low volatility, and they can be in the oddest places, you know, and have no necessary advanced education. It's just there are people who are naturally talented traders. Of course, it also includes, you know, people who are PhDs, you know, develop quant methodologies, but they may not be PhDs in the UK or US. They could be in some Eastern European country, you know. So it's that type of thing, and that's the basic. Now, from that, you can find traders which are basically undiscoverable any other way, and our plan is to. One of our big plans for OneSeeder Investments is to, we have an index actually that we've done. This is kind of interesting. When I took over the analytics of this thing, over 2.5 years ago, there was an index. I looked at it. It was like top 5% of traders. And I said, hey, you know, this is, the CEO whose idea this OneSeeder was, a fellow by the name of Manuel Bellari, you know, brought me into it as one of the founding partners. When I looked at this, using originally started out using white labeling somebody else's software. We eventually built our everything from scratch, except for one indicator, one performance metric called the OneSeeder score. But this index they had was the top 5% of traders. I said, Emmanuel, this is ridiculous. He said, you take any group of 10,000 traders. And take the top 5% at any point in time, 5% of them are all going to look great. What does that tell you? But the point is that 5% changes all the time, so it doesn't tell you anything. So I said, this is garbage. You got to throw it out. So I created I designed a new index, and I designed it so that it could be replicable. And by that, I mean it used no hindsight. So the way the index works is at the end of every month, you take top 5% based on this OneSeeder score. And you assume equal allocation to those traders for the following month. And then the next month, you do the same thing. So every month's results is based upon what you have identified as the best traders going into that month, not, you know, as at the end of that month, which is meaningless. Mm-hmm. So we run that index. We've run it now for over 2.5 years, and it's done extraordinarily well. And in fact, it did so well that the third co-founding partner, a fellow named James Bibbiggs, who's our compliance and operational expert, said, you know, one day called me, says, Jack, you know, look at this index. Are you sure it's right? I mean, because it was just looked too good to be true. And I said, you know, I've been kind of thinking of the same thing myself. I said, I kind of did some checks, you know, and I believe it's true, but I'm not a programmer. I can go through the code. And so we had hired a mathematician to consult with us, and who's also a guy who knows programming and actually a UK-based fellow. And anyway, gave him the assignment to go through as he went through the code to fine-tooth comb. And essentially, I mean, there were some incredibly minor things that he did find, like because traders were in different time zones and the program, sometimes there wasn't a last day that show up because of the time zone they were in. but it didn't really affect the index by anything. It was mm-hmm. Some of these minor, a couple of these minor quirks, which might have, made a few tenths of difference one way or the other, sort of a wash. But those are type stuff. But the basic index was correct, and essentially, so what that is demonstrating is that we have found, this process has uncovered some really good traders, and moreover, that it seems to at least perpetuate, at least so far for over 2.5 years, seems to perpetuate at least next month. And our plan is to do an index, do a fund that will tend to replicate the index as closely as possible. And so that will be our first major product. And we're looking to do that this year. And I mentioned to you, we're in discussions with a major financial entity right now, which I can't name because it feels not completed.
Yeah.
But hopefully that'll all go through and there will be such a fund sometime this coming year.
Oh, fantastic. Well, hopefully when that all goes through, you can come back on and tell our listeners a little bit more about how they can possibly get involved.
Sure.
Well, Jack, listen, it's been fantastic talking to you, fascinating, and I'll hopefully catch up with you again soon.
Yeah, sure. It's fun doing. Thank you.
Thank you, Jack.